Hello and welcome to the Doorstops Podcast with Dr. Cody Price. In case you've missed it, previous and future episodes of the Doorstops Podcast can be found on Audioboom, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, Stitcher, and TuneIn. Please be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe to the Doorstops Podcast so that you don't miss any updates about housing issues in Ohio. You can also follow the podcast and other research that the Office of Housing Policy at the Ohio Housing Finance Agency does by following our Twitter account at Ohio Doorsteps. So let's get started. I'm Dr. Cody Price, and I'd like to introduce you all to my guests today, Jennifer Walters, Andrea Boxall, and Mara Klein. Jennifer is the president of Fairfield Homes, a development, general contractor, and property management company located in Lancaster, Ohio. Andrea is the deputy director of the Governor's Cabinet Opiate Action Team at the Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services, and Mara Klein is a mental health administrator at the Ohio Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services. So I want to thank you all for coming in today. I'd like to start this conversation off by kind of really talking about the opioid crisis that's kind of happening in the state of Ohio. Andrea, can you really speak to us about the opioid crisis, specifically how it began and then kind of spread throughout Ohio?
Okay. Well, first, it's important to note that this isn't the first time that we've dealt with a drug epidemic, and even more specifically, it's not the first time we've dealt with the opiate epidemic. It is the first time that we've had the overwhelming number of deaths and overdoses as a result of opioids. So the most recent episode, the one that we're in now, really started probably 2009, 2010. And what we're able to do from the data that we collect is to able to kind of go back and match up Board of Pharmacy data with the Department of Health data for overdose deaths and kind of create, if you will, like an algorithm of what happened. And what we found is the prescribing of opiates went up astronomically for a few different reasons in the early 2000s. One being that the pharmaceutical industry through the FDA was allowed to advertise medication on television, which had never been done before, as long as there were things that were described like signs and symptoms as a result of use or side effects. So we had that. And then we also had the ability to take one medication and make a generic medication. So you had this proliferation of the same types of medication going out there. But in addition to that, you had a pharmaceutical industry that really kind of withheld information. Maybe some would see it not so much as withholding, but thinking that the addictive nature or property of opioids was not as significant as it was, as it is. And so you then had medical folk who were signing on to it, major industries that were signing on to it, saying, you know, Oxycontin, Percocet, Darvocet, these are all really good medications to use when addressing pain, particularly chronic pain, and it's not addictive. And that is the perfect storm. The ability to advertise on television, having doctors and other prescribers sign off saying that it's safe and that it's not addictive, and having people be able to almost self-diagnose what their pain was. So you had a large number of pills being prescribed. And as we all know, if you're prescribed a medication, we don't always take all of the medication until it's out. And then even if we don't take the medication completely, we also don't dispose of it properly. And so what you had were people who were being prescribed large numbers and then who were keeping the medication, though they weren't using it, which basically created this idea of easy access for people, not just young people, but in particular for young people, but also for other people who were drug seeking or who were trying to address their pain with medication that hadn't been prescribed to them. And so if you follow that train of overprescribing to people taking pills that weren't prescribed to them, to them becoming very addicted to those medications and not being able to get them legally, it then promotes drug trafficking and illicit drug use. And that's kind of where we're at today, from pills to heroin to fentanyl to now we're on the hopefully coming on the other side of that, seeking treatment and recovery services.
I mean, you've mentioned a few of these types of opioids, but can you give more description to what they are? Maybe what is most prevalent among them? Like, what are the cases that you're most likely to see?
I think that, you know, we've certainly, through the Governor's Cabinet Opiate Action Team under Governor Kasich, the development of that team was to work across systems. So it's not just people from the Department of Mental Health or Job and Family Services or Medicaid. We also have people from the Department of Public Safety, Veterans Services, Department of Health, and the Board of Pharmacy. And so what the Board of Pharmacy has shown us is the types of medications that were being prescribed are for pain. So let's say a person has an acute injury or surgery, maybe rotator cuff. They were being prescribed pain medication so that it could help address the pain, not necessarily the healing from the surgery or the healing from the injury. What it essentially does, again, is it numbs the pain wherever the region is and makes the person feel at ease. The problem is the receptor that it actually hits in the brain. The more you take of an opioid medication, the less effective the medication becomes. And so a lot of times in treatment circles and recovery circles, you'll hear I'm talking about increased tolerance. This isn't an issue of tolerance. It becomes ineffective once you start abusing the medication. So some common medications that are prescribed: hydrocodone, Oxycontin, Darvocet, Percocet, morphine is also a common medication. Fentanyl actually is prescribed, but typically it's prescribed to people who are in licensed nursing home facilities or who are receiving hospice care for a chronic condition that we know is not going to get better. But the formulation of that, typically it's in a patch, so it can be laid on the injury or the location of pain. But they certainly have other methodologies, over-the-counter medication as well. But again, that's monitored by the FDA. It's highly regulated. You know the exact dose that you're getting versus what has happened in the drug dealing aspect. What you're seeing there are people who are taking maybe illegal heroin, which is still an opiate, and they're doing what's called stepping on it with other products. Sometimes they do that to make it seem like they have more of the product than they actually do. They might mix baking soda or baby powder in it, or Comet, you know, cleaning agents, all of which can not only make it look like you have more, but can also do even more harm long term. The other thing is when you step on something with fentanyl, it takes such a very small amount to cause an overdose to occur. And even more potent than fentanyl is carfentanil, which is used to sedate pachyderms like elephants, rhinoceros, things like that. And people have ordered it over line, and they'll mix it in, again, two intentions: expand their product and quote-unquote give you a better high, even if that better high ultimately ends up killing someone.
You were kind of mentioning this governor's cabinet opiate team. And so can you kind of tell me more about it? When did it start? Why was it envisioned and kind of addressing these issues?
The governor's cabinet opiate action team falls under the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services. If you understand the president's cabinet, the governor also has a cabinet. And there's a director for each of those cabinets: Medicaid, Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services, even the Department of Agriculture, Department of Education, all of whom we've worked with to say, we know we have an epidemic in our state with regard to opioids. How is your specific department addressing that epidemic? And then what we do is we meet once a month to almost develop ideas and work across those offices to say, you know what, if your job in family services and part of their responsibility is children's services, protecting young people, what kind of training are you giving to your caseworkers on understanding the signs and symptoms of addiction, the disease of addiction? What kind of things are you doing to keep your staff safe? What kind of placements are you looking at for children who grow up in that type of environment, who need to learn self-regulatory behavior? We might work with the Department of Public Safety, as we have, specifically State Highway Patrol, on if you're interdicting drugs on the freeway on a typical stop, what are you looking at in terms of keeping yourself safe in case it has been contaminated with fentanyl? Do you have naloxone available? But we also have collaborated across all of those systems to apply for robust grants, one of those being the 21st Century Cures Act grant from the federal government, as well as the State Opioid Recovery Response Grant, which has ended up resulting in about a total of $70-something million, a little over $70 million, but not just for one component. Yes, we're looking at prevention in elementary schools, junior high school, also prevention with the aging population. We've invested in the expansion of medication-assisted treatment around the state, whether that's through buprenorphine being Suboxone, methadone, or Vivitrol. We've invested in drug courts. We've invested in educating and teaching prescribers on how to prescribe medication-assisted treatment and that it's not effective, completely effective, if you don't have treatment. But we've also invested in peer recovery supports and housing. And I think that Mara can give you a better idea of some of the things that we've done with our housing dollars.
Yeah, so I work in the Bureau of Recovery Supports and Housing, and we do all sorts of things there that, you know, Andrea mentioned, like help people become peer supporters in the community. And that's, you know, when they have experienced either a mental health diagnosis or substance abuse diagnosis in the past, and then they want to go on and help others recover in the future. So they are able to go through a certification program if they want to, and then help those folks in the community in lots of different types of settings. Another thing that we do then is different kinds of housing, and we have permanent supportive housing, residential facilities, and then also recovery housing. And that's one of the things that I spend most of my time doing. And we have lots of different kinds of funding sources available for folks if they're interested in helping to develop that in the community. The department has really invested in recovery housing over the last several years, and more recently has invested capital funding, general revenue funding, and then we also got some more federal funding just coming through department just this year. Most of those dollars are available through your local alcohol, drug, and mental health boards. So if folks are interested in that, that's where I would encourage them to go. We can also provide a lot of information about who to contact regarding those funding sources. But the state opioid response funding was what Andrea mentioned, and that funding is coming available fairly soon. For recovery housing, we have just a little bit over $6 million that's going to go towards just recovery housing. And our focus is going to be working with families and medication-assisted treatment in recovery housing.
Do you guys see this crisis kind of slowing down anytime soon? I mean, I know it's kind of gone through generations that you've talked about, and the drug of choice and how that's really transitioned. Do you see it slowing down?
Absolutely. We see it. You know, I can't stress again, Dr. Price, the importance of submitting your data. A lot of times, and I've worked on the other side, right? I've done work at the local Adams board level. I've worked with private nonprofits, and I've been frustrated having to collect data and do the paperwork and push it through. But the data is what tells us the story. The data is what tells us where we need to invest. And the data is what tells us there's a problem. So as frustrating as it often can be, understand there's a means to an end. And so for us, data is what told us our efforts are working. Right? So through our 21st Century Cures Act, I believe we've trained over 250 more prescribers in the state. What that does is increase access to medication-assisted treatment. We looked at our prescribing protocol efforts. We developed first ER prescribing protocols. It used to be you could go in and get 30 days of medication if you went in ER. Now you're going to get 3 to 4 days and told, as you should be, follow up with your family physician. Then we did acute prescribing guidelines, and then we did the chronic care. If you go on to takechargeohio.org, that is our website that will give you more information about where we've been and where we're going, as well as treatment that's available, as well as housing that's available throughout the state. But what the data showed us from the Board of Pharmacy is prescribing has gone down significantly. Even more so, what we looked at was what's quote unquote a doctor shopper. So I think when I started in this position in 2014, we had over 2,100 doctor shoppers in the state. I'm really proud to say that that's under 300 at this point. That can only happen because of the system that we helped invest in and develop across the table with the Board of Pharmacy through the Governor's Cabinet Opiate Action Team, which is a one-button touch that has the Ohio Automated RX Response System, so that if you get your prescription filled, we're going to know immediately that it was filled. Your prescriber is going to know, so that if you try and go to another doctor or go to another pharmacy to have it filled, that's not going to happen. So I see the improvement 1,000 times over. We just had our recovery conference a couple of months ago, as well as, well, it was the recovery conference, and they have this big get together on the State House. It's remarkable and inspiring to see so many people who have entered into treatment, who have recovered, and treatment in every capacity, right? And who have recovered and who are celebrating their recovery with other people. I know that recovery works. I know that treatment works. And I think that what we have to do is provide this kind of wraparound of support that get rid of the judgment, treat it as you would any other disease. And just like any other disease, we're going to be making leaps and bounds every day in the treatment.
Thank you. I think that you've mentioned a lot of good points bringing up housing. And I think this is a nice kind of transition into talking with Jennifer about Fail Forward Homes before we kind of get to some of the solutions that you guys have come up with. But can you start off by telling us a little bit about Fail Forward Homes, such as when did it start and what do you guys really specialize in?
Yes. So Fairfield Homes is based in Lancaster, Ohio, and we started our company in 1947. So my grandparents started the company as affordable housing, but mostly single family housing developments throughout Fairfield County. And it was affordable as in, I'll take your horse for a down payment or I'll take your car. And my grandfather was known of driving a new car or a new old car every other month when he, you know, took a down payment for a house. So that type of affordable housing we started in, and also expanded into insurance and different things. And then in the late 60s, my father joined the company, and that's when we really expanded into multifamily and through government subsidized housing through HUD and rural development. So our whole multifamily arm really kicked off when he took over the company at that point. And then when that program ended, the tax credit program came along in 1986, and then that's when we got into that. So really since the late 60s was our first technically affordable housing and multifamily.
We're over, what, 50, 60 more years?
Right.
Where all have you guys really developed or completed projects? Is it just in Ohio? Is it concentrated in specific counties? Can you kind of tell us about where you build geographically?
Yes, our footprint is majority Ohio. Just recently we have expanded out into West Virginia and Kentucky, but we've really concentrated in Ohio and mostly suburban and rural areas. Our footprint is as far as Mansfield, but then we're very concentrated in southern part of Ohio.
And what are your strengths with developing affordable housing? What sets you apart from other developers?
That's a great question. I think one aspect is we're vertically integrated. So we're a longtime owner, meaning that we develop, manage, and build. And so what we develop, we know we're going to hold on to for a long time. So some of our properties, we have our first property we ever developed and built. So we're constantly putting money back into that and rehabilitating our communities. And so we're heavily invested in the long-term investment. So I think that sets us apart from people who are not long-term owners. So we really try to, on the front end of building, look to see, okay, we're going to have, you know, this community is going to be part of our portfolio for 30, 40 years. Are these some of the right decisions?
What are some of the biggest challenges that you guys have faced as an organization with building affordable housing?
Some of the biggest challenges, I think it depends, like over the last 40 years of being in affordable housing, I mean, it's really dependent on what's going on in that time frame. So sometimes it is that there's not enough funding, or the tax credit pricing is really low, or interest rates are really high. You know, we've gone through that time period. Also, like for right now, our major challenge is in construction. We really struggle with finding highly qualified subcontractors and people who are getting into the construction industry. So today we're trying to be a lot more innovative on how do we reach kids in the school system who want to get into property management, who want to get into construction, because employment or staffing is some of our biggest challenges today. It has shifted throughout the years as far as we have had some NIMBY issues. We've had communities who don't want affordable housing in their community, even though they need it. So we've had a myriad of different challenges.
Jennifer's answer touched on an issue that we're dealing with, even with regard to the opioid epidemic, which is workforce and workforce development. You're talking about a field, social service, that isn't economically a smart decision from a parent's perspective. You know, you're sending your kid off to school. You're saying, you know what? That's not where the money is. We also are seeing the workforce development issue with people who, as opposed to going to colleges, they're not going into the trade industries, which can be very profitable. And so we're dealing with it on a different side. You know, not too many people want to move to a rural community to provide treatment, you know, and the closest store is 30 miles away, or there's not a movie theater within 20 miles. Like, people are looking at this from the perspective of, I want to work in the field, but I want to be where a lifestyle can support me in another way. fortunately, we've been investing through the opioid epidemic and through the funds we've received from both the state as well as federal government. We've really been investing. How do you motivate people? How do you entice them? You know, how do you say, listen, you've got a high school diploma and you're certified in X, we want to make you certified in Y. And so if we can pay for you to be able to do that, as well as you still being able to work, that might motivate folk to go into some of this work. But I think it's very, very difficult. I did have a question.
Sure.
One of the questions I have is, how do you get people to understand that affordable housing doesn't mean destitute, it doesn't mean broken down or slumlord? How do you get them to understand that actually having a recovery community can benefit your neighborhood?
So a lot of what we do on the state level is education to communities. And we also partner with a great organization that I'll give a shout out to, Ohio Recovery Housing. We have funded them from a startup when they became an affiliate, NAR, National Association of Recovery Residences. Ohio Recovery Housing helps with a voluntary certification process. But they do a great job of educating communities and helping with recovery houses throughout the state. Just educate the communities and reach out to people when they want to become recovery houses and want to open up. And because it is really, really difficult sometimes when you want to be a functional part of the neighborhood, because at least for recovery housing, it's part of the neighborhood. It's not a facility. It's not an institution. It's not a homeless shelter. It's not even a halfway house. It's part of a functioning community. Sometimes it becomes a fair housing issue. So they'll actually help too with connecting folks to legal aid, things like that. But we also on the state level provide some of that information, but not that we want it to always go to that. Right. But we do encourage folks to reach out to folks in the community and let them know, hey, this is what we want to do. It's kind of part of their good neighbor policies, just to let them know that, you know, hey, we're part of the neighborhood and we want to be a healthy and functional part, because that's part of the recovery process, is integrating back into the community from what was happening when you were really suffering from your addiction.
Well, to add on, I just don't think affordable housing is very sexy, like the word. And so, you know, it's been the same word for a long time, and we as a world have evolved, but our description, we call it tax credit housing and affordable housing. Awesome, serves great purpose, but it's not sexy. And I think that, like, when I'm talking to people outside the industry, I try to put a face with affordable housing. Like, it is the school teacher who has four kids and is a single parent. That's who we're housing. Or it's the police officer that's protecting you. So it's, if we could get, like, and I probably need to do a better job of finding more types of people that we all house, because I think that people get it when it's your neighbor or your the person who's teaching your kids, and oh my gosh, great, that's a wonderful thing you do. But when you say, I'm proudly a developer of affordable housing, you sometimes get some strange looks of not understanding. And then, is that government housing that, you know, it's just that confusion.
Housing right out of college, right in downtown Kansas City, Missouri. It was this great, huge building that used to be a bank, and they redid it. And, like,
oh, wow, it's probably beautiful.
It was gorgeous. Everything I dropped on the floor, like, broke.
Yeah,
but yeah, it was tax credit, because, you know, I was right out of college and I was a caseworker, and I didn't know it at the time. I thought they were just giving me discounted rent.
But it serves a great purpose.
No,
look at what it, like, did. Like, Mara is a success story. I mean, because you can't afford, the gap is so big that coming right out of college, being a caseworker, how are you going to afford $1,200 rent? You can't.
I heard that the necessary income for a one-bedroom apartment, you need to have $21 per hour
in market.
For affordable market housing. How can you? I mean, it really speaks to the program that you have. And again, yes, we're speaking specifically of recovery housing, of people who have the disease of addiction. But I don't want people to think that those who are dealing with the disease of addiction are people who are not educated, who don't have families, who are not employed, who don't have cars or insurance. It's all of that. And sometimes housing is what, like, everything is resting on, right? Shelter. Having the safety of shelter for you and your family and providing the stability that's needed for your recovery process. It's not always the image. In fact, I would venture to say more often than not, it is not the image that's being promoted, and for to use your word, Jennifer, because it's sexy or because it sells the story. It's really the people who come to these conferences who work in this industry who've benefited a lot from those very services.
And I think the social desirability of the people that are living within affordable housing changes a lot. I mean, I'm currently working on a research project that's kind of asking neighbors of affordable housing and having them rank about 8 different groups of individuals on what priority they should have with affordable housing. And unfortunately, people recovering from drug and alcohol addiction has been given the lowest priority, whereas seniors are given the highest priority, then maybe veterans, then young families, police officers, and things like that, looking at more of the workforce housing. But I still think the people that need it most, being that of those recovering or even homeless individuals, are still given a low priority on this scale.
And I think the reason they're given a low, there's two primary reasons that people in recovery or people with chronic conditions or diseases are often given that lowest priority. There's two reasons. One is the moral issue that's still tied to the disease of addiction and the misunderstanding. We need to do a much better job and be consistent. You know, even within recovery communities, you'll have individuals say that the disease of addiction is a disease and then say, but you're not allowed to take a medication. It is a chronic condition. And for any other chronic condition, we're constantly looking for treatment methodologies, including medication. So you can't have it one way or the other. It's got to be both. And that's the other thing we tend to do. It's always either or. It can never be an and. It is an and. And if you consider, it's the smallest population, those who have the disease of addiction and those who are homeless, but they also take up the greatest amount of resource. So it almost seems like we should flip what the priority is, because short term and long term, you're going to get your investment paid off. And actually, I think a lot of times, again, that's the group that tends to buy up or use up the greatest amount of resource, is the one who's the smallest representation of the homeless population. So it's not an either or. We need to treat them all at once. But I think we need to recognize that if we keep doing this prioritization, that those who ultimately need, the longer it takes, the longer we wait, the more the cost is going to be.
Yeah, and I think this kind of moves us in a good direction to start talking about Pearl House. For those that may not know, it was developed by Fairfield Homes, and it's an affordable housing community that serves the needs of homeless families recovering from drug and or alcohol addictions. So before we kind of get into the specifics of the project, can you kind of explain this initial vision? What was really the big picture? How did this really come together, thinking about creating housing for the specific population?
Yes. So this is where I will become vulnerable and say that I was that person that did not understand opiates, addiction, especially did not understand drug addiction. I had, you know, judgment. It's a choice. I was that person. So this was in 2009. I was called to be on jury duty at the federal court. And so it was, you know, I'm super naive. I have two babies at home. You know, I'm living in the bubble. Life is awesome. First court jury seat I've ever been on. And it was a case about this heroin dealer who was on trial. And it was over 2 weeks long. And it blew my mind, as far as I was exposed firsthand on 30 people testifying how their lives were chained by addiction, and that how they handled heroin, and they were driving up into German Village every single day and getting, you know, just how this whole operation worked. I mean, it was a language I didn't understand. And what really hit me hard was that I could easily say, oh, I'm going to Columbus, you know, I'm outside of my environment. Well, the stories that I heard and the testimonies that I heard, some of the people were in Fairfield County, and they were, you know, bringing back heroin down into Fairfield County. Now it's my territory. What? Oh my gosh, what? This is the place I grew up. What's happening here? So that was the first time I was really exposed to, in my world, this crisis. And so when I was off jury duty, I went back home and contacted our judge who ran the drug court and said, do we have a heroin and opiate problem? And he said, what? Is your head in the sand, Jennifer? You know? And so I went to drug court. I experienced that. And I just got really passionate about it because one was I'm not in recovery, and there was a part of me that thought, oh, you know what, I can fight for this population, because sometimes I think you need all kinds of people to fight and speak up. And so I just came with a different perspective. And so I reached out to the recovery center, and we just started having a conversation. And it was one of Tricia, who is executive director of the recovery center, was explaining how desperate need of housing they have, because being in Lancaster, we have a 10-bed shelter, or, you know, we don't have huge shelters and people aren't camping out under, you know, we don't have a homeless community in an area. So they're in really bad living environments, and families were living in cars. I was naive in my first big development. We're a developer. We're affordable housing. We can solve this problem. This is no big deal. And it started like that. It was really just, this is a big problem. Let's solve it and we'll figure it out. As it started to develop more, even people in our own office said, affordable housing is different than permanent supportive housing. We do this, but we don't do that. And so it was a big challenge for us and a big step in the right direction, because it's all one umbrella and we can do it. It's different kind of work. And then we also brought in and asked Lancaster Community Action Agency to be our partner as well, because I learned real fast that there's no one person that can do it all.
Right.
And it's been a great partnership. Lancaster Community Action Agency is our partner in the ownership of Pearl House, and they're also boots on the ground and help all our families with life skills. And they bring a lot of services to the table. And then the recovery center specializes in recovery. They are the ones who are able to administer the medication and really personalize everyone's service plan. So that partnership was vital.
Can you start by describing this development process that was taking place? So I'm not a developer, but I assume one of the first steps is almost securing a site. And you said that you are working in Fairfield County. This is where the issue is happening. How was the site selection process like? And were you experiencing any NIMBY issues when selecting a site?
Our NIMBY issues did not start until way further down the line. So it's a little bit different in this situation. So when we created our development team, the three organizations, one of the other problems that the recovery center brought to our attention was that they were on the outskirts of Lancaster. So you had to actually drive to get to them. Their building wasn't really conducive to all the treatment plans that they wanted to provide. Real huge barrier to get services. So if you're going to do something innovative and new, you just do it big. And so we created this campus-like environment. So we decided, let's find a site that can handle bringing recovery center downtown as well as Pearl House. So when we house our residents and they're living there, all they have to do is walk across the parking lot and meet with their counselor. So with that, we also knew that to be successful through our training through Corporation of Supportive Housing and Sally Lucan, that people had to walk to services. So Job and Family Services are downtown. A lot of the churches that have the AA programs and different programs were downtown. We had United Way downtown. We had Family Y, which was walkable. And so all these things were downtown. We also wanted to be close, but not in the heart of everything. So what we found was there was an old hardware building that was foreclosed on, bank owned, and next to it was a used car lot that was relocating. So it was just one of those things that just opened up and it was perfect. So we had a ton of support in the beginning. The superintendent of schools supported us. We had Job and Family Services, you name it, we had support. It was just, oh my gosh, this is going to be great. We can walk down and we can help you and we can, you know, this is going to solve a problem in the schools because kids are coming to school. They don't have a home. They don't have anything. So we had a lot of support in the beginning. So our NIMBY issue didn't start until after we got funded. So we got funded at 36 apartments through the tax credit program, and we were zoned. So it was just this actually like really awesome situation. And so once we were funded, that's when really we started seeing problems. And what happened, and this is the best advice I can say to people out there, is that we were just about, and we weren't going to really, in this case, because it was so new and people really didn't know about it and things, we wanted to wait to see if we actually got funded on something like this. Does this match with OFA? Are we aligned and things like that? So we waited, and we weren't aware of any negative voices in our community. But what we arranged was that once we were funded, we were going to go and into the library and have a presentation. We had elevations and information, and we were going to have it in a nice, quiet area where we could present of what we were building and what exactly Pearl House is. So it was arranged. We scattered the neighborhood and all the businesses and the community neighbors on, we're going to have these two sessions, informative, come learn about Pearl House. Well, the paper got ahead of us and called us a shelter, and that we're going to build a homeless shelter for drug addicts. And that was the title of the article in downtown Lancaster. You know, shelters are great, but nothing was accurate. And so it became so disruptive that the chief of police called me the night before we were supposed to present to the community and said, just for everyone's safety, we are going to have police officers there and the fire department will be there. It was more than me. You know, I have partners and these are other people's lives as well. So we canceled our community meeting because we don't need to have it in a negative space like that.
But what you just said is the very thing that you noted earlier. It's not sexy.
Right.
If you're describing that kind of project as an answer for a community need, the potential for jobs in terms of construction and development and safe housing and revitalization in the downtown community, that works. But to then take it and use, I mean, it sounds very deliberate in terms of the selling of a paper. And I'm not from Fairfield, so I'm just... But I want to sell articles. I want to sell the paper. I know exactly what to put. And to use words that when they're separate, shelter is a great word, right? Like recovery, great word. But if I put that together, all of a sudden I've made a project something that nobody should want. And hopefully Pearl House has proven everyone wrong, right? Did you stay in that location?
Yes. So this was combined with the Recovery Center and Pearl House. This was a over $6 million project that we were pouring into downtown.
This is a good story. This really is.
I'm talking about a lot of stuff I don't really like say in presentation, you know. But anyway, Dr. Price is pulling it out of me. yeah, so $6 million we're pouring into a community that 7 years ago had a dilapidated downtown. There were maybe two restaurants downtown. Now we have seven restaurants downtown, tons of retail, a lot of revitalization. People want to live downtown. So we got behind. And what happened that there was a group who formulated, but it was more than just bringing Pearl House to Lancaster. We are a community that was built around anchor hawking and that whole small town success story. And we really kind of broke open and said, we have some problems here. We're here to help solve them, but we do have some issues and they're painful to see. So we announced in the paper that we would meet with anyone, anytime, any place, as long as it was under 10 people. You know, we wanted small groups that we could have dialogue with, have conversation with, and things like that. So that would have all been fine, except for the fact, because remember, we were zoned appropriately. So nothing was really holding us back. We were funded. We were zoned. We had Huntington Bank who stepped up and said, we want to be the sole investor. But what happened was there was a group of actually my friends, my parents' friends who lived in the historic district and formulated a group that really put pressure on the city. So long story short, our zoning was reinterpreted. So we're no longer zoned. Remember, we were funded on 36 apartments. It worked. it was going to break even at 36 apartments. We were project-based subsidy for all of those 36 apartments. Now the city has reinterpreted the zoning code. We're not zoned appropriately now. We're zoned appropriately now because it's different. It's a different project.
Okay.
So we met with OFA and here's our issue. What do we do? You know, and we still had all this overwhelming support, but it was many city council meetings. The organization, it's called Citizens for Downtown Lancaster, retained an attorney. We retained an attorney. And then the city of Lancaster retained an attorney. And we basically went to court through city council and BZA. And we lost. So $100,000 later, we lost our zoning variances. So we went back to OFA and we went back to our architect and said, we still have these tax credits. If we can show you what we can do and build it through the zoning code, can we all work together? And OFA was phenomenal. And so we came up with the 21 apartments that exist today. It fits into this zoning code as far as setback. You know, there was a height requirement. So what we did was we dug 10 feet down and our first floor is partially underground, but we met the height requirement. The second floor is cantilevered over the parking lot. So the children's playground is under the second floor, but it works. And like I said, OFA was supportive. Huntington was supportive. Ohio Capital Corporation was our syndicator. Everyone bent over backwards to help make this work.
The people who had concerns, the downtown area, where are they? How many years ago? And where are they now? Are they like supportive?
They're quiet. So that's great. And a lot of our residents work in their businesses. So to me, it's a huge testament. We don't talk about it too much as far as, because it's peaceful. So it's awesome.
You just took me through the process. I've thought about this kind of work and would not have thought about the depth that you went through, both literally and physically.
It was some physical, like there was some people were accosting me, grabbing me and you know, the whole way along, like I can take care of myself and we're a for-profit company. Okay. So we have the ability to choose whether we want to put money into this or not. I'm taking the Recovery Center and Community Action Agency with me. And it was painful. People were threatening their board members of, we're going to not write a donation check to you. We're going to talk to OMAS and not get funding for you or the Adam H. board. And so it was just really harsh and emotional. But the best thing too is during this time period, I would go into a restaurant and there was a situation where a server served me my food and said, I just want to thank you. Thank you for sticking up for us. And that was all she needed to say. And the clients of the Recovery Center, when we walked into our first meeting, city council, everyone was wearing these bright orange shirts and it said, it's our downtown too. And it was just very fear-based. Everyone was very scared. There was a lot more emotion going on to the people of the Citizens for Downtown Lancaster. You know, they were scared. They didn't have my vision. They weren't inside my head thinking like how great this was going to be. So we have peace. And it's been fabulous. We have wonderful statistics from being open after 4 years. We now have some data and we can show to other people. And like I said, our residents can walk to work. They're employed by downtown businesses. They are active members of our community.
So Pearl House opened its doors in 2014. You were talking about different things that can be found there. I mean, you mentioned the playground, but what can one find there? Can you just kind of talk about what is all in Pearl House? What type of on-site services are there?
We have two doors to access and are locked 100% of the time, and that's mostly to keep our residents safe inside. Everyone's issued a key fob, so they have their own access in and out, but strangers and non-guests can't enter the building. We have a property manager on site, and then we also have a case manager. The case manager is employed by the Recovery Center. The case manager for Pearl House services all the families. We also have a certified Head Start program that is in our children's room at Pearl House. So inside Pearl House, we have an exercise center. We have a family reunification center or activity room. So Job and Family Services uses that room to reunite families. Then we have a community room that has a kitchen, TV, things like that. We have parenting classes, cooking classes, things like that in there. And then right beside the community room is a children's play area that goes out into an enclosed outside playground. When we opened, the children's area was just a children's area. It was open to all the residents. You could go 24/7, which you still can today. But what we weren't expecting is we opened on November 1st. By January 1st, we had 12 babies born at Pearl House. We were overwhelmed with the amount of babies, to the point where we were buying cribs because we expected older kids. So with that, Community Action Agency wrote a grant and received funding to certify the children's area into a certified Head Start program. Head Start comes in for 0 to 3 years, and the parents can drop off their kids in the morning. And this isn't daycare. They're working with the kids and caring for the kids, and drop them off, go to their counseling, go to their GD class, wherever they're going, knowing that their children are safe and that they don't have to pay for childcare on those certain days.
Can you kind of walk me through a typical resident process? So how are individuals or families referred to or that come to Pearl House, and talking about that process, where are they coming from?
Individuals and families are referred to Pearl House by one of two ways. One is the client initiates the referral, meaning that they want to come live at Pearl House, or the recovery center or another agency refers the client to Pearl House. To be eligible, the clients must have children, because we're family housing and we're all two bedrooms and project based. So the voucher houses the whole family. The client must also not have lost permanent custody of his or her children. So I'll talk more on that in a minute. Clients must meet the Metro Housing requirements as well, since Metro Housing provides the vouchers. So basically, the recovery center sponsors our resident. They have a recovery plan. Then the recovery center places them on a waiting list that is held at Metro Housing, because we, as the housing provider, we take any family. We don't ask questions. We don't do our background check. We don't have anything that will stop you from living here. So when I say that the client must not have lost permanent custody, what we do is, what we were finding in the beginning is that we also work with drug courts, or the drug court of Fairfield County. And so a lot of times a parent will end up in drug court because of using or something like that, you know, and so they will lose temporary custody of their children. And then the drug court will say, come back when you have safe, affordable housing and we can work on getting your children back. You can't live at Pearl House without custody of your children, because that is a housing authority requirement, but they can't get custody of their children back because they don't have safe, affordable housing. So they're living, you know, their car doesn't work as housing in this case. So what we worked with Metro Housing was, can we have a waiver for 90 days? Let's have these parents, if they're sponsored by the drug court, let's have these parents live here, or this single mother or single father, live here at Pearl House. They have 90 days to work with the drug court to get custody of their children back. After that 90 days, if they have their custody of their kids, they're great to stay. If they run into barriers and they can't, then we work with them on finding some other housing in the community, and then to still work on getting custody of their back. But we have that waiver, so we try to make that work that way.
Just wondering if you had an age cap, like how old they can be for them to live at Pearl House.
No, we don't.
How long are people typically staying? So once they have their children under custody, or just in general, like if a family is going there, how long are you seeing people staying at Pearl House?
We have had our first, I want to say, 14 families that moved in November 1st. 14 of the 21 families stayed 2.5 years and moved on to more independent housing. The nice thing about that too is when, and I think it is 43% of our residents have lived there for at least 1 year. But we're finding that it takes about 2.5 years for families to really get stable enough and comfortable enough and confident enough and have the resources to be able to move on to more independent housing if they so choose. Other nice thing that we do is that their rent is 100% subsidized when they move in. So residents have to be homeless or at risk of being homeless. And so when they move in, they don't have any money. Their rent is 100% subsidized, but we do charge them $300 security deposit. So, but they don't have that. So St. Vincent de Paul has agreed from the beginning, they'll pay half of the security deposit of $150. So when a resident moves out, if they move out on good terms in their housing, they can take that $150 with them for future use. Then the other $150, we work out a work program with them. So if they think, hey, I can pay you $5 a month, great. But something to where we're starting to enter real life responsibilities. So just some small responsibilities that we want you to have. And then also they have to put their utilities in their name as well. And if they can't do that because they're unable, then that's where Community Action Agency steps in and works with them through the PIP program. So when they move out, the goal is you have a security deposit that you get back that you can apply to somewhere else, that your utilities have now been cleaned up, they're in your name, and then you have all kinds of other goals.
Getting at these kind of next step, do you do any follow-ups with previous residents? Like, do you know where they're at currently that have been through the program or no?
Yes, I can share some statistics. Okay, so some of our outcomes that we've seen since we've opened our doors, 70 adults and 87 children have lived at Pearl House in the past 4 years. 43% that have resided at Pearl House for at least 1 year. 75% of those adults worked or became enrolled in a college or certificate program during that time. 71% of the residents acquired a vehicle and a license. 17 babies were born drug-free. 18 kids were reunited with their parents after being in emergency child protective services custody. And 19 child protective service cases were closed and the kids were able to remain in their home.
That's great.
That's huge. Yeah. Yes, yes. That right there is huge for Fairfield County because we don't have enough foster families, and we all know that it's always best. Yes, yes, is the best. These are huge milestones for this population, and they have been able to achieve all of this because they have safe, affordable place to stay, and they focus on their efforts of recovery. So, and the recovery center, like I said, is right next door, and everyone has their own individualized recovery plan.
Given the success of Pearl House, I mean, you guys are going to be doing Pearl House 2 in Zanesville, Ohio. So can you kind of talk about that? Is there going to be things that are done differently based on the experiences that you've had with Pearl House?
Yes, it is going to be under the same general model. What we're doing differently in Zanesville is we have, in Lancaster, we have all 2-bedroom apartments, and in Zanesville, we'll have 1, 2s, and 3s. So we will have some single adults living at Zanesville as well.
So it just won't be families?
It won't just be families.
Okay.
And we will also have larger apartments because what we found in Lancaster was that we're having to find some housing for people who have larger families. So we're trying to accommodate that for Zanesville.
Do you identify family as only a married couple? Can they be same sex? Can it be boyfriend, girlfriend?
Definitely. It's not our place to define what family is. We have all types of families in our community.
That actually kind of stems a little bit off what I asked you earlier about the age limit, because there are some family housing for recovery housing throughout the state that limits the age of when they would serve the population. So why, I can't quite answer.
They might have different funding sources. So sure, the uniqueness, or what I think is great about Pearl House, is that we're permanent supportive housing as well as under the recovery model. So we're not all of one or the other. With permanent supportive housing under that model, they can live there for as long as they can pay rent, you know, and they follow their lease. So it's not transitional housing. It's not when you finish this program. Nothing's officially tied to it.
Given the success and publicity of Pearl House 1, was it easier to gain community acceptance with Pearl House 2 in Zanesville?
Definitely. And also, Pearl House Zanesville will start construction in 2019. So we're 4 years after we opened our doors in Pearl House Lancaster. We were able to go to Zanesville. Actually, Zanesville asked us to come to them. So that's really how we are building Pearl House Zanesville, is that the Recovery Center of Zanesville, which is Muskingum Behavioral Services, came to us as well as the city. We had a lot more statistics to share and proven, you know, some success model. Also, people who were concerned from Zanesville could come up, touch it, feel it, see it. We could give them a tour. They were allowed to talk to residents. We were completely transparent, and they could see exactly what they were going to get.
Do you see the Pearl House model being scalable? So you originally wanted like 34 units, then it went to 21. Is Zanesville going to be similar in size, or do you see it housing more people, or does it need to be a certain size to kind of be successful?
Zanesville is going to be 34 units. So that is a good target because it can be financially more stable at 34 units, and it's also small enough to where a community can wrap their arms around it. And I believe it's scalable. the biggest barrier is achieving project-based vouchers for this type of housing. Remember, we're housing people who are at risk of being homeless and are homeless. So we need that voucher to help people be successful. And they have stepping stones into, you know, they might not need it for very long, but they certainly need it for 6 months.
Also, from the Ohio MOS perspective, we definitely continue to encourage more recovery housing and this type of model as well throughout the state. The one thing that we talk a lot with the operators about is this very question on, you know, what is a good size for recovery housing? And most recovery housing, traditional recovery housing, has always been like single family and very small, anywhere from like 8 to 10 beds. But there have been more different kinds of projects that have come in and very creative opportunities as well. And one thing that we hear from the operators who have been around for a long time is when you scale it up and up is just from the recovery side, staff becomes more complicated. And the reason I spoke up is because I didn't hear that part of it and just wanting to make sure that when folks are in recovery, they do require and want more interaction with staffing, wanting to make sure that they continue to follow along the steps in their recovery. And so we do want to make sure that that is paid attention to as well. So it just depends on the model when we kind of talk about making sure that, you know, all of those things are in line to make sure that it's still a healthy community for everybody.
And lastly, where else in Ohio is a project really needed? Are there plans to do more? And maybe Mara, you can speak more to this topic on where you guys are kind of seeing these types of issues happening around the state.
Well, I think I mentioned before, but we definitely want to, the department definitely wants to encourage recovery housing throughout the state. And we do have multiple resources, including funding, to encourage that and everywhere, especially where we, you know, have not had as much investment before, which, you know, we had the general revenue funds and capital funds that have come through the state over the last, I think, 5 years, but just the last couple years, we've had more influx into the mental health boards and made sure that those areas that really hadn't been touched before, we wanted to encourage recovery housing in that area. And that would be specifically to address this issue of not just opioid crisis, but any addiction. So I would say anywhere where there is not projects, we'd want to encourage.
After everything we've discussed today, what are the major takeaways that you guys wish everybody would know?
My takeaway is more on the children. So I don't know if everyone knows that the recovery process impacts the kids. And so my biggest takeaway about developing Pearl House is that the opioid crisis is hitting adults, but the heart of this project is that we're caring for the kids and keeping families together. And we have seen the biggest impact on that. And having safe and affordable housing and this model of recovery has kept a lot of families together in Fairfield County. We're only one piece of a very large puzzle, but everything helps. The other thing that I don't think people realize is that Pearl House residents develop their own community during their time there. They build a new support system, they're developing healthier social behaviors, and they're even asking one another to watch their kids. So it is an extremely healthy community within the campus of Pearl House.
That's crazy because I didn't know that you were going to say that about the kids and families. Because one of the major takeaways that I was thinking of when we were going through this was that we at the department really do want to focus our recovery efforts now on serving families, because it does seem that we have focused more on individuals and some of these subpopulations, but families as well as like LGBTQ and youth, just the populations that really haven't been focused on until, you know, now we're seeing, well, they don't really fit anywhere else. And families, of course, like you're realizing, as you mentioned, that full, and this project has really helped all these folks. And, you know, I'm sure you're going to be full in Zanesville right away. So yeah, we definitely, one of the things I would really encourage is to work with families, as well as the other thing that I've been mentioning is the resources that we have available to help anybody that is wishing to work with this issue. We're available at Ohio MOS, and I'll give OFA a plug too, because you've wanted to talk about some of the big issues. So thanks for your attention to the issue today.
Oh, you're welcome. And thanks for speaking. One last question. So if you could have everybody read one book, what would it be?
Mine would be Love is Letting Go of Fear by Gerald Jampolsky. Basically, it's a super powerful book with a profoundly humble message. So
I'm just going to mention one of the ones that I read more recently. It's called Beautiful Boy by David Sheff. And it just came out as a movie. And it actually has everything to do with the opioid crisis and those folks who have absolutely no idea what it's like to be a family member or to suffer from the addiction. I would definitely encourage you to read this book or watch the movie if you don't like reading.
Well, thank you guys for coming in today and speaking to us. To my listeners, please be sure to rate, comment, and subscribe to the Doorstops podcast so that you don't miss any updates about housing issues in Ohio. You can also follow the podcast and other research that the Office of Housing Policy at the Ohio Housing Finance Agency does by following our Twitter account at Ohio Doorsteps. Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Cody Price, and this is Doorsteps.